Shalom Aleichem, Chevra, Binyamin Hammer here at National Council of Israel. Wanted to have Rabbi Willig again be with us to answer our shilas. We are up to our post-Purim, pre-Pesach shilas here, conference call number 24. We thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Okay, question number one. A couple married according to civil law. He's Jewish and was never halachically married. She was not Jewish. Now she has converted and they are getting married. Kedasu Kedin. Is there Shiva Simea Mishta, 3 days, only the Sudas Chasana? Okay, I understand that the primary question of Shiva Simea Mishta is concerning the Sheva Brachos. That's why I understood the question. And the Pischei Tshuva discusses this in Simon Samach Beis of Cotton Tess, quoted from a Chassam Sofer, who says the following situation. A person who was never married before, but was, in his words, a Noef, Pony Noef, and he married a Be'ula, a woman who was not a Psula. So the Chasam Sofer Paskins, against the Noda Be'uda, Chasam Sofer Paskins, that you do say Sheva Brachos all 7 days, since it's his first marriage. So in this situation, this is his first marriage, because before that, when he was married according to civil law, that was not a halachic marriage because she wasn't Jewish. If you look carefully in the expression of the Pischei Tshuva, the impression is conveyed that according to the Noda B'Yehuda that says that you would not have Sheva Brachos, that's assuming that he marries the woman with whom he had been intimate. Kol Shekein, Be'ulta D'Lav Dilei. Even more so, according to the Noda B'Yehuda, you would not make a Sheva Brachos if he's marrying a different woman. Therefore, here too, in the case of a Pony Noef who married a different woman, the Chasam Sofer says you would make Sheva Brachos for 7 days. How much more so where he's marrying the woman with whom he had been intimate? And therefore, the Psak Halacha is, in such a case, it would be Sheva Brachos for 7 days, as for the Chasam Sofer, as quoted in Pischei Tshuva. As far as Simcha is concerned, there is a dispute in such a circumstance. In Simon Samach Dalet Siv Beis, are there 7 days Shiva Simei Mishta, or are there only 3 days of Shiva Simei Mishta? And there's no firm Psak in this matter. It's probably up to the couple as to how they want to conduct themselves. Question number two. What is halacha about setting up a coffee maker on the timer to brew coffee on Shabbos morning? It's a very common thing that people bake their own coffee nowadays. And they brew it and the people are fanatic about their coffee. It has to be done a certain way. It became almost a religion called coffee. In my view, it should not be done on Shabbos for one of two reasons. It may be prohibited, even what we call technically, there may be something called an Easter of Hachzara. Now, Hachzara in our minds means to take of food and put it on a heat source on Shabbos. In this case, whatever was put there from before Shabbos. So at first glance, there should not be any problem of Hachzara. However, the Chazon Ish has a ruling in which he writes that we're not discussing a prohibition of an action. It's a prohibition of a situation. And therefore, the situation is that something is on a fire which comes on Shabbos. It's the equivalent of your putting it there on that fire on Shabbos. Remember, the Rabbeinu Tam is the one who said the reason why we're more strict to put something on a fire on Shabbos, as opposed to leave it there from before Shabbos, is because we're afraid that the amount of time that you pick the pot off the flame before you put it down again, it became somewhat cold. So if it becomes somewhat cold, we're afraid they're going to stoke the coals, things of this nature. However, in our situation, the food is ice cold a second before the machine goes on with the timer. And therefore, it seems, according to this ruling of Chazon Ish, that there will be a problem of Hachazara, which is a technical violation, even though you set it all up before Shabbos, since the fire is coming on via the Shabbos clock on Shabbos morning. So according to that opinion, it would be technically prohibited. It seems to me that even if there are those who disagree technically with the Chazon Ish, because after all, you put it up from before Shabbos, not on Shabbos, nonetheless, I believe here there's a really serious question of a possibility of bishul. People who are into their coffee to such an extent that they don't want to even go one day without freshly brewed coffee, they're often careful how it's brewed, when it's fully made. The possibility is they may, for example, give one example, pick up the cover of the of this coffee brewer, see how things are doing, and put it back again, which may can be considered an isa min haTorah, a Torah prohibition of bishul, until the coffee is fully cooked. And there could be other things that one could do to intervene. And therefore, it seems to me it's not right, even if it's not a technical violation, it's not right to do this on Shabbos. Question 3. Snow shoveling by a Jew or Gentile on Shabbos in front of a shul or home. Monthly snow plowing contract with a company. They plow on Shabbos. A family has a plowing contract. And finally, putting down salt or sand on the walkway on Shabbos. It seems that shoveling snow, in any event, whatever you'll say, is at most a rabbinical prohibition. Not one of the 39 categories of work. And therefore, asking a Gentile should be permissible under the general principle of shvus to shvus b'makom mitzvah. And the mitzvah here is to prevent people from slipping on the slippery surface where there's too much snow and ice. That seems to be obviously permissible on that basis. Now, problem is raised. What if they plow, not shovel? The word shovel to me means you take a shovel the old-fashioned way, and plowing generally means with a machine. And the question is, may they come and do the work on Shabbos with a machine? The possible heter for that is that even though they will plan to use a machine, but from your perspective, they could just easily use a shovel. In some ways, a shovel is better than a machine, does a better job. They're too lazy to do it with a shovel. It's much too much of a strain. So they come with a plow. But they have to if they did it with a shovel. And it's not as if it's a shovel is such a remote implement that no one would ever do it. Many people, could be even most people in America, clear the snow with a shovel. Those who can afford it or have a service have a plow, but it's not as if a shovel is such a remote, freakish possibility that we should not take it into account. So therefore, it seems to me that since if their plow broke and they did it with a shovel, you would have no objection at all. You're not telling them to use a plow, you're telling them just to make sure that the sidewalk is clear. If they decide to come with a plow, again, you didn't tell them to come with a plow on Shabbos. They decided on their own. And once again, we can invoke the principle of shvus to shvus b'makom mitzvah. There are many who will claim that even a plow may not be a Torah prohibition, unless some kind of a fire is lit in some kind of an engine. But some plows don't have that. If there's no fire lit, it's like a fan, an electrical device, which according to most poskim against Chazon Ish, not Issa Daraisa when you complete the circuit. So it's another reason to assume why it would be shvus to shvus b'makom mitzvah. So therefore, it seems to me, if a non-Jew does it, there's ample room to be done by a non-Jew. Yourself, if necessary, obviously with a shovel only, you can even do it yourself. Shmir Shabbos Kolkosa writes in the new edition, Perek Chaf Hei, Sif Yud Aleph, that it's better to do it through a guy, even if there's no technical violation on the part of the Jew, because of what he calls zilzul Shabbos. It's a degradation of Shabbos. You're working very hard, sweating. It's strenuous to shovel snow, and therefore it's better to be done by a non-Jew. If you can't find a non-Jew, there's room to be lenient for the Jew to do it himself if it's going to prevent people from getting hurt or having difficulty walking and potentially tripping. I believe it's permissible. The last part, putting down salt or sand on the walkway, is discussed also in Shemir Shabbos Kolchasa in the previous Sif Yud. He permits it, even though it presumably is an Issa Derabbanan, but the Gemara says that an Issa Derabbanan is mutter to be done to prevent what's called Nezek Derabin, a Gemara in Shabbos. And here, if you don't salt it or sand it, it's likely to be a Nezek Derabin. Many people walk by and someone could slip and get hurt, so therefore it would be permissible to do a Derabbanan. We assume that sand and salt are Derabbanans, even though there are Gemaras which talk about being Mosif al Abinyan, adding things to a certain type of ground surfaces. If they're going to be there permanently, it may be an Issa D'oraisa. Our typical surfaces, whether it be concrete, asphalt, or sidewalk, whatever it may be, whatever you're putting there, the salt or the sand, we're not going to stay there forever. It's going to be shoveled away, washed away, melted away. It's not going to last there indefinitely. Therefore, we assume it's a Derabbanan. And as a result, even a Jew can do it to avoid Nezek Derabbanan. If you get a guy to do it, even better. Question 4. I recently applied for a position in the rabbinate and met with the search committee of the shul. The committee members wanted me to know up front that the pulpit is shared and that on a rotation every 4 to 5 weeks, a designated congregant gives us a Shabbos morning drasha, a man. To continue with the search process, I would have to agree to this. Should this be a reason of concern? Absolutely a reason of concern. Absolutely. A rabbi takes a position. The pulpit is his pulpit. If he decides to share it with somebody else, he wants to give another person a chance to say a Dvar Torah, whether it be a guest from outside or maybe even if it's someone from the community, that's his choice. But if a committee is going to put other people up without his consent, without his designating first, I don't think that should be done. Certainly, it's a possibility that the Balabatim will put up somebody who is really unfit, who will say things which are not appropriate. Even if whoever they think will say appropriate things, this is the rabbi's prerogative, the pulpit. That's how the rabbi is defined in our times and place. So therefore, this is certainly a cause of concern. Now, if a person feels that get the job, and then you'll be able to explain to the Balabatim that, you know, you want to have someone speak every 4 to 5 weeks, the rabbi has to approve who he is, and then you can use your decision-making to see to it it's done properly. That is one possibility. And you never know, down the road, if the rabbi is popular enough, he can eliminate it completely if he so desires. If the rabbi wants a week off every month and have someone give the drasha for him, that's okay, as long as he's the one, the rabbi is the one who chooses who else should speak from the pulpit. Question number 5. There's a grape juice manufacturer that produces diet grape juice with reduced sugar. As far as I was told, the way the sugar content is reduced is by adding more water to the juice. This company advertised it as 1/3 less sugar. Can one still use this type of juice for kiddush or other mitzvahs that require wine and grape juice? So I didn't know the answer. I didn't know the facts. I called the OU. I spoke to Rabbi Rabinowitz Shalita, who's in charge of the wines. He told me that, yes, the facts are true. They add water. However, in all of the grape juices that are produced under the OU, there's at least a majority of straight grape juice. Straight grape juice. Not concentrates, not water. Straight grape juice constitutes the majority. And as such, everyone should agree with Ashkenazim, Sfaradim, Mechaber Ramah, that it's kosher for Kiddush and kosher for Abakosis. As is. Of course, you shouldn't be adding more water on your own, unless you consult ratios from the experts or from some of the ads that are put out by the Kedem company and others. Question number 6 and 7, we'll do them together. Is there any issue with expressing condolences to someone who married a non-Jew? She has now passed away. Is this different than wishing a mazel tov to someone who was intermarried on the birth of a child? Question 7. What is the proper way to deal with an intermarried couple that comes to the rabbi for, quote, marriage counseling, end quote? Is there a different psak if you are a therapist instead of, parentheses, or in addition to, close parentheses, a rabbi? Now, we understand, let's take a step back over here. Intermarriage is a disaster. That's what's destroying Klal Yisrael. It's a terrible, terrible thing. It's a phenomenon which was not that common 100 years ago, even in this country. It existed, but it was what we call in our language a miyut she'eino matzui. It was a, as the Mishnah of Yaakov would have it, a single-digit phenomenon. It started even much lower than that. It was still single digits, probably till the 50s at some time. Then it started climbing, and unfortunately, it's now over 50%, unfortunately. It's a terrible, terrible problem. It is destroying the Jewish population of the United States of America, the non-Orthodox population, that is, and they're being decimated. And it just keeps getting smaller and smaller. Certainly, if the man is Jewish and the woman is not, and the children are not even Jewish, according to the strict halacha, even the other way around is not exactly good. So therefore, someone married a non-Jew who passed away, he, according to the Chazal, he's chayv koris. That's koris midivrei Kabbalah. Kanoim pogimbo in the olden days. A very serious violation. This is a relationship with something which we cannot in any way legitimize. So therefore, you meet the guy and his non-Jewish wife passed away. If you say something like, you know, endorsing the marriage while it existed and sorry that it came to an end, that would be something very, very bad. At the same time, the Jewish person is now in personal pain and having lost a spouse in his eyes. He viewed her as a spouse. If you can say nothing, it's even better. If you have to say something, the something should not in any way refer to a marriage. There are cases in America today where a couple is quote-unquote living together without marriage. That's also bad. A man can have this relationship with a Jewish woman, and she passed away. It was also bad, their relationship. They were never married, so you can't say, you know, something about your wife. She never was a wife. But, you know, in a certain difficult case, if you have no alternative, you can express certain very generally defined sympathy. How exactly to phrase it, it's hard to know. Usually condolences is a more technical term for passing of a first-degree relative. That would be inappropriate, but just some other statement that, you know, you somehow, I'm sorry for what happened, something like that. That's as vague as can be. You know, what happened, fill in the blanks, that an illicit relationship is terminated. Are you really sorry for what happened? From a pure halakha perspective, not at all, because as a result, an illicit relationship was terminated. At the same time, there's a human element, and very often today, the Jewish man is tinuch shenishba, doesn't know any better, didn't do it out of spite. But you should try to stay as far as you can away from any reference whatsoever to any kind of marriage. I'm sorry, something like that, for what happened. Without going into details. If you can avoid it completely, it's even better. That's as far as a loss, and the same thing is true as far as a birth. A birth in some ways is worse, because especially if the man is Jewish, he literally, as the Gemara puts it, holed ben l'avodazar, he sired a child for the church, because the child is not Jewish. And it's a tragedy. The Rambam is so strong in the 12th parak of Hilchos Yisrobiya to explain how serious this a violation is. Even if on a technical level, it may not be that serious, but on a more general level, it's the most serious. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And therefore we should, and it's still going on. Who knows how many years it's still going to go on. The first case, it was terminated by the death. They're just getting started out, having babies. It's really not a good thing. And how do you handle it? He says, oh, I got a mazel tov, I had a baby. He's sort of stuck in a bad spot. So ideally, you should say nothing. If a person has to say something again as vague as possible. Not recognizing that this is a Jewish child, the word mazel tov as a Jewish ring. If you have to say something, you may want to say something like congratulations, even though you don't really mean it fully because it's a result of an illicit relationship. But the further away you get from any marriage or Jewish term, if you have to say something, the better off it is. Every case is unique. There's a concept of eis la'asos l'Hashem, that you go against the general rules because of other outside considerations. This is the rabbi's local call, each and every case according to its own specific fact pattern. As far as the idea of marriage counseling or advice, I don't see how this is possible. How can you put in your best effort to maintain a marriage, which according to your understanding of religion, is a prohibited one? I don't see how you can even do it. There was once a rabbi who told a group of psychologists, and they asked him this question, fellas, you know how to give enough advice to make sure that the marriage will break up. Yeah, that's a very nice and quick and sharp answer. I think you have a problem of stealing to do that because they're paying you money to preserve it and you're trying to undermine it. I don't think it's a good idea. I think you should just stay away from it. Whether you're a rabbi, whether you're a therapist, or whether you're a rabbi therapist, if you're a firm Jew, you should not be putting your efforts into saving a marriage, which according to your own most deeply cherished values is something which is against the halachic system. Question number 8. An ailing elderly couple has asked me a shaila regarding Yerusha. Does the din of Bechor, Pishnayim, apply today literally? Answer, absolutely yes. All the laws of the Torah apply literally. We'll see soon that maybe you should do something about it, but the first question is clear. The answer is yes. The Torah says so. It's for all times and all places. Even if you'll tell me that some of the, how should we say it, some of the historical background which existed at the time of Maamad and Har Sinai no longer exists, what we call primogeniture, and there was homesteads and the oldest son would take it over, doesn't make a difference. The Torah's halachas remain unchanged, even if the reasons for it no longer apply. It's called Lo Darshin in time of the crop. Even if the reason no longer applies, the law still applies. And maybe the reasons do apply, we don't know for sure. So the first question, the answer is yes. If it does, must they calculate all their belongings, real estate? The answer is yes. All their belongings and their real estate, that's the father's estate. Many cases, people pass on today, their house is their single greatest asset by far. By far. So their belongings and real estate is almost synonymous. And yes, by strict halacha, a bechor would get a double portion of the belongings and the real estate. No question about it. Bank accounts, totally different story. If you have a bank account, you have $10,000 in the bank account, they don't necessarily have it. They're waiting for you to get it. It's invested. It's put into all kinds of money-making instruments. What it really is, you give them $10,000, they owe you $10,000. It's a debt from the bank to you of $10,000 they have to pay to you when you write a check for that amount and ask for the money. That we call, according to most poskim, ro'oi, as opposed to mugzuk. Mugzuk means what's literally in the possession of the father. That would go down with the laws of pi shnayim, and the bechor gets a double portion. However, that's only mugzuk if he's holding on to it literally. Houses, cash in his pocket, in his mattress, safe deposit box, diamonds, whatever you have, that's called muzak. However, low outstanding loans, accounts receivable, things of this nature, this is what's called roy. It's fit to come into your ownership, but it hasn't come yet. According to most postgame, bank accounts are in the category of roy, and therefore the b'chor would not get a pishnayim of the bank account. Okay. What about his wife? After she passes on, after 120, does she have the same obligation? The answer is no. The answer is no. The law of pishnayim is found in the context of a father whose possessions are inherited by his sons. However, it does not apply to a situation where a mother has property and then it goes down to her sons. All this is strict Torah law. However, I feel I must absolutely add, otherwise it will lead to a wrong impression about my opinion on this matter, that yes, this is in fact the strict Torah law. Nonetheless, I don't advise that people follow the strict Torah law. That may sound perplexing, coming from a rabbi, someone who seems to be loyal to halacha, to make such a drastic statement. I would like to refer you to something I wrote about this, both in Hebrew and in English. It's called, in Hebrew, it's a Kol Tzvi Yud Beis, which came out in the year Tav Shin Ayin. In English, preceded by a bit, is something called TorahWeb.org, something that was written called Inheritance Without a Fight. And I wrote that article at the request of Rav Shechter Shalita, who was seeing too many fights in families over these matters, that people were unhappy with the division of property as it was declared by the deceased parents. And there was terrible, terrible fights. I read it from the Gesher Achayim, who was the Rav Tukachinsky, a preeminent halachic source. Now the custom is to give to daughters, whoever has Eina Barosho, who's thinking ahead, make sure to leave for your daughters in the will. Why? That's the custom. Two, she may get it by secular law, and they can come, as is the worst, to Reeve and Machlokas. They can come to fighting. Fighting is terrible. He tells a story. Talmud Chacham Asher Echad Asa Masa. A Talmud Chacham was very wealthy. What did he do? He inchil b'tzava es kol rechusho rak api Torah. He said, all my property should be distributed according to the strict law of the Torah. A b'chor gets two portions. His two sons get their portion. So what happens? The b'chor gets 50%. The two brothers, other brothers got 25% each. Three daughters, zero. And I read you the last sentence of Rav Tukachinsky. V'hinchil sino v'tacharis upirud b'mishpachto. What did his children inherit? Not just money. Hatred, competition, and divisiveness. Ala she'omru abrios, the people said about him, shelo kedai hoyo lahashir rechush lahorish sino. It was not worth it to leave over property and to bequeath hatred. End quote. That's a very sad story. Very, very sad story. But that's exactly what happened. Now, the idea of leaving money for a daughter is not something which is just beginning in the 20th century as being appropriate. Those who are familiar may know that the Ramah speaks about this. Already in his day, in the 16th century, and presumably even a century or two before, there exists a concept called a shtar chatzi zachar. They weren't quite egalitarian as today. They wanted to give a daughter a half a share. So, for example, For example, if there is a man who has two sons and two daughters, so by Torah law, let's assume there's no Bechor. So each son gets 50% and each daughter gets 0%. So the Ramos Shtachat Yizachar provides that each daughter gets the half a share of a male. So instead of being divided 50-50, we divided one-third for each son and one-sixth for each daughter. This is found in Choshen Mishpat and Ramos Simon Reish Pei Aleph Sif Zayin. Now, this was satisfied the progressive individuals of the 16th century. I would not go over too big in the 21st. Take it from me. In my view today, we need what we call a shtach zochor sholem, which means that the woman should get the same amount as her brothers. And there is a reference to a shtar zochor sholem in the poskim. The Ksos quotes it somewhere. And that's what should be done, in my view. This is what has to be done to avoid machlokes. Now, how does the shtar chatzi zochor work? In the olden days, it was even written before the marriage, because a shver would be giving money, and he was afraid of all kinds of things happening, different marriages, different heirs to his new son-in-law would take money which was his and give it to people who were not even related to him, become a whole part of the financial negotiations pre-marriage. And then they did it in an irrevocable way. Today, that's not such an issue anymore. I mean, there's plenty of issues without this. So a shtar chatzi zochor is written as follows in the Ramos classical case. The man indemnifies himself, let's say, to his daughters. He has two sons and two daughters. He indemnifies himself to a tremendous sum of money, more than he ever dreams he's ever going to have, with inflation. And he says, I hereby indemnify myself, I obligate myself this amount of money to my daughters. Okay? Now, he says in the classical iteration, if my sons will give my daughters a chelek chatzi zochor, then this obligation is null and void. So now, the sons have very little choice. If they give their sisters nothing, the sisters will take away the entire inheritance as creditors, because the father's estate owes the money to the daughters only. Creditor precedes an heir, as you well know. If the sons will give the daughter a half a share, then the obligation of the father to the daughter is null and void, and the father's desire will be fulfilled after his death. The sons will get a full share, and the daughters will get a half share. This can be updated to be utilized in conjunction with these days everybody has a last will and testament. A last will and testament is done by a lawyer, and when the person passes away, he decided to divide the property, that's how it should be divided. Once again, I go back to my original advice. It should be divided equally among all the children. Sons and daughters, a Bechor and a Poshet, all the same. Divided equally. That's the only way, in my view, to avoid a machlekes, avoid a fight in today's world. Once that last will and testament is written, then the man can write, I hereby obligate myself to my daughters a tremendous sum of money, more than they'll ever have. And you say, if my sons will abide by the terms of the last will and testament and give their sisters whatever is written in that will, then my obligation is null and void. In this way, once again, the sons have no real choice but to uphold what it says in the will. And they can't say, well, the will is not really binding according to the laws of the Torah, whatever it may be, and there's plenty of things to discuss. We don't have time. Doesn't matter. It's going to be effective. And therefore, that's what I recommend everybody should do. Write a will, divide all the property equally. In order to make the will halachically binding, you fill out that's what our version of shtach chatzi zochor. A similar version is found in a sefer called Midor L'Dor, Rav Feivel Cohen Shlita, with some variations. The form that I prefer can be found in that Torah Web article. It's written in English. And you fill it, if a person has a will, he fills it out. He can give it to anyone who can acquire it on behalf of the daughters. It should be kept quiet. It can be given to a Jewish attorney. It can be given to a relative. It can be given to the daughter as well. Not everyone wants the daughter to know what's in it. Every case is somewhat different. Now, this is true, in my view, of the surviving spouse, male, female. All the money should go equally to the children. I have another opinion, which is that if there is a surviving spouse, all the money should go to the surviving spouse. The Gemara Bava Metzia talks about someone who is unfortunately beholden to his children. And the children have to support the aging parent. That's not a good idea. It's not a good idea. It's something which is a very serious matter. I read you the Shalom. Based on the Gemara Bava Metzia, I inhale it base. He wants to give his money, and then he's stuck without any money. Says the Shalom. They're rich and they have money. They give their marriage a lot of money. They keep for themselves. They think it's enough for them to live on the rest of their lives. Zeu shtus gadol. This is a silliness. Great silliness. V'shtus asher yochel lavo l'day averi gadola. Ki mi yodeh mayolad yom. Ulai yishapach agagal al ha'av. The father loses money. V'oy la'av asher yovo al shulchan bonov. Ki hu dovo sheneged ha'teva. Many of us know that we're supporting our children, Baruch Hashem, even after they're married. It's not good if children have to support their parents. It's just not good. It's against the nature and it's against Teva. So if I don't recommend it at all, I recommend if a person has a will, leave all the money, everything to the surviving spouse. And the couple can make up between themselves. The surviving spouse will in fact divide the estate, whatever's left, to the children equally, using the instrument known as a shtar chatzi zochar. Now, as far as the interspousal inheritance, for the woman, she need write nothing because by strict halacha, the man inherits everything as well. And there may be questions of roy and bank accounts, etc. Maybe it pays to write even in her case. The man, he simply writes a note of indebtedness to his wife for more money than he'll ever have. So if he passes away, and the sons will say, the money belongs to me, because after all, we get Yerusha. Our mother gets a pittance for a ksuba and a this and a that. So then she pulls out the piece of paper, and she collects all the money as a creditor, which he wanted her to collect anyway, only for any conditions, that kind of a case. This is an add-on to the actual question which was raised about the ailing elderly couple. That's what I would tell them if they listen to my advice. Notwithstanding the fact that this is not in accordance with the laws of Yerusha found in Torah Seinu HaKadosha. And if you look at those articles, you'll see halachic backing for what I just said, based on Gedolei HaPoskim, the Gesher HaChaim we saw, the Rav Zalman Nechemia has a piece, the Rabbi Chaim Kolmitz had a whole sefer written on it. And other Gedolim as well, as a beautiful sefer called Mishpat HaTzava, from Eretz Yisrael, also has a whole sefer about this. Yes, the Poskim say, in order to be able to fulfill the laws of the Torah somewhat, a person should leave over some properties to be divided strictly according to the Torah lines, where the Bechor gets Pishnayim and daughters get nothing. What is that item? So in the olden days it said, your Sfarim and your Karka and your real estate. So Zalman Nechemia writes, today, the real estate is the single most important asset in most cases. In the olden days, there was a concept of a homestead, a family homestead. You wanted it to go to the sons, and maybe to the Bechor twice, as we said, primogeniture. Today, it's apartments and houses don't stay in the family for generations. The couple passes on, you sell the house, and the couple of the other people are living elsewhere. It's just an asset. So therefore, I think that should be included in the regular assets to be divided equally. And the Svarim, oh, Svarim should be divided only amongst the sons, because at least where I come from, the women don't use all the Svarim. And that the Bechor get a Pishnayim there, so the laws of the Torah will be fulfilled, at least with respect to a part of the estate left over by the person who passes away. Okay, this, I believe, is the proper thing to do as far as Yerusha is concerned. I took up a lot of time with this. I'm just end up with the last question. I'm sorry. Last question. I can't even answer, really. Question 9. I'll be baking shmura matzahs with some members of the kehillah for the first time this year. The baker has a morning shift and afternoon shift. We are baking for the first 2 hours of the afternoon shift. Would the beginning of a second shift be considered tanur rishon? Tanur rishon is not a Talmudic concept. Tanur rishon is a semantic concept. You want to have less chance of problems, so you can do it with what we call a tanur rishon. It's simply a matter of marketing. It's a matter of what the people expect when they buy tanur rishon. A similar issue exists with respect to what we call 18-minute matzahs. As far as the machine matzahs. 18-minute matzahs. What does it mean? I used to thought it means the first 18 minutes of the day, because they do a tremendous cleaning overnight, and it's very, very clean in the morning. The first 18, now, well, it's the first 18 minutes after a major cleaning, after the lunch break, this afternoon shift. Once again, it's not a Talmudic term. It's a matter of semantics. You don't want to deceive people. So in order to, whether it should be designated as 18 minutes or designated as Tanur Rishon, it's simply a matter of convention, of what people are expecting. And I'm not convinced that every single matzah bakery has the same definition of what these terms mean. Caveat emptor. If you want to buy Tanur Rishon or 18 minutes, you should find out what it means, and no one should be guilty of deceit. This is my answer, semi-answer, to question number 9. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi, very much. We appreciate it. We hope we can call upon you again in a couple of weeks, Mr. Shem, before Yontif.
Okay, Mr. Shem. Okay, call to.
Thank you. Bye. Take care,
bye,
everybody.
Bye-bye.